Hi, my name is Bruce Perham. Welcome to my podcast series, Trauma from the Frontline. In this series, we'll be interviewing a wide range of people that work in the frontline industries who will be sharing their professional and personal thoughts and ideas about working in the field and some of the challenges that they all confront. Hi, this is Bruce Perham. Welcome to my podcast series, Trauma from the Frontline. Today, my guest is John A. Shuford. John is regarded as the national leader of the award-winning immersion experiential methodology of staff development training, utilizing the 4 E's principle: engage, energize, empower, enjoy. He has delivered these proven innovative staff development trainings nationally and internationally for 30 years, with notable results in improving work culture, morale, staff relationships, and cooperation between departments. He was trained as a rehabilitation counsellor with a strong interest in trauma healing and has held numerous leadership positions. Based on his 30 years working with corrections staff, he has recently published the book Mid-21st Century Criminal Justice, Work Culture Transformation, in addition to his consulting practice. John was Correctional Training Coordinator 2 with the North Carolina Department of Prisons. And John can be reached at his email, which we'll put at the bottom of the podcast. Welcome, John. That is no mean background, and I've been very interested to talk to you about training and workplace culture in particular, because both topics are really, you know, huge here, and I know in the States as well. Would you mind just giving me a little bit of a background about how you came to work in corrections, or how you came to be interested in the corrections field?
Well, first of all, I want to say I am absolutely delighted to be here. I have listened to your podcasts, and they are providing such beneficial information, and I just hope it's widespread how many people. You know, you started with Katarina Spinaris, who has done some absolutely groundbreaking work in research, and it's just an absolute delight. So, I was trained, as you said, I was trained as a mental health therapist working in community mental health programs, and I've had a strong interest in trauma and in trauma healing. I was a volunteer with the Alternatives to Violence Project since 1990. And that's a program that's in Australia as well as in the US and worldwide. And it works with inmates, those who are incarcerated individuals, to help them change their attitudes. And it's had incredible results. And the training that I do with staff is based on the same methodology as that program with the AVP. And AVP started in 1976. So there's been 15,000-20,000 of the workshops done. So it is definitely proven very effective. And with the AVP program, I've done trainings around the US and in Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. And I was on the organizing team for AVP USA and for AVP International. And as I said, I've been doing emotional intelligence training corrections all staff levels, and that's really significant. It's not just COs, but it's supervisors, administrators, and having them all in the same training. And I've been doing that since 1992. I've written feature articles for American Correctional Association, American Jail Association, and the International Association of Correctional Training Professional Publications. And that's been the basis of my book. And it's interesting that in 2016, I read the US President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing document. And all of my work has been in corrections. So I have seen firsthand, the impact of chronic stress on staff. I didn't realize it's the same with police, with law enforcement. And then listening to your podcast, I realize it's the same with EMS, that those organizations that are paramilitary in structure suffer many of the same issues, whether it's law enforcement, corrections, or EMS. So that's how I got here. Actually, I was doing AVP in a prison, and the warden asked me, hey, it's had such a positive impact. Can you try it with our staff? We've been having a lot of issues with our staff. So I tried it with the staff, and that's how I got started.
Wow. One of the things I thought, the first question I might ask you, John, is in reading your book, I loved it. Very thought-provoking and really connected with so much of what you said. And the first couple of chapters or so where you go through the scientific data in terms of mental health and the impact on correction officers and police officers. And, you know, and I certainly are aware of the enormous impact on these officers, but to actually read the statistics and to read the research that you did and the people that you've tapped into, it's a little bit overwhelming. And, you know, I was really interested in your own, in a way, having done that, your takeaways of the end result, or this is what the data says about the impact of this work on individuals. I'm really interested in your thoughts.
I think it's important to realize that when officers, whether in law enforcement or in corrections, come into the workforce, they don't have these problems. The problems are caused by the culture. And it's not caused by the what we call operational stress. There are three kinds of major stresses: operational stress, organizational stress, and family stress. And the operational stress, you know, going to an accident, the day-to-day work in the prison, we know that's what to expect when you go into the profession. What you don't realize is the chronic stress that comes from the organization, from the lack of empathy, for the lack of concern for staff, and the impact it has on your family. And that, to me, is one of the major revelations that in my research, is that it's not the people and it's not necessarily the tasks, although the tasks can be very stressful, but it's how people respond to it. Let me give you tell you about why I say the organizational stress is so important. In Vietnam, when the American soldiers came back to the U.S., they were disdained. They were spit upon. They were rejected. And there was a very high rate of PTSD. The Viet Cong went back to their villages. They had suffered some of the same stress and trauma. When they went back to their villages, they were accepted as heroes. They had no PTSD. There was another war in Vietnam, a border war with China, and that was not a popular war. So when they came back from the border war, they were not accepted as heroes, and they had high levels of PTSD. So what you know, and so many people know in corrections and law enforcement, it's tough it up. Okay, so it's tough. How you doing? I'm doing okay. I'm good. And then you go to the next event. There's no support. There's no processing whatsoever. That's where the damage comes. And that's part of the work culture that is so harmful. And so that's... that was probably the biggest revelation, as well as the seriousness of the impact on the psychological and physical well-being. It just, as you said, with the statistic, it blows you away to know that, if you want to get into some of those statistics, I can do that, but it's very stark.
What you're saying, John, I often, in doing these podcast interviews, it's really been a great opportunity for me to reflect on some of the things I've experienced. And I've become very aware of people like me that sort of work in these systems and have worked in systems for decades, become almost sort of accepting of, Oh, well, that's just sort of how it is.
Hey, man, it's the job.
And it's the...
Don't complain. And, don't gripe. It's the job.
And it's the job. And what I've learned through the podcast is there's so much experience and there's so much knowledge that officers say to me all the time, really, right throughout, about the, you know, I talk about management or talk about what you said, that lack of support or lack of awareness or no one cares, we're only a number, we're a bum on a seat. And there's never sort of really a lot of focus on that. Everyone kind of, there's no real attention paid to that. And so what you're saying and what I read in your book about the importance of what's around officers, you know, I really connect with, and I'm interested. And look, before I lose my train of thought, on you mentioned the paramilitary running of these sorts of organisations, and I can remember the first time I went to a parade, which it's called the morning meeting here, and this some years ago, and it was sort of, I almost felt like saluting. You know, it was sort of a very regimented. What, sir, are you here? Yes, sir. You know, blogs, are you here? Yes, sir. You know, and I was really taken away by that in terms of the rank and the formalness. I hadn't really thought about it. But, and maybe that's mellowed a little bit over the years. I'm not sure. But really,
I'm not so sure it has.
Really interested in your thoughts about, and one of the questions I had, and we'll talk about it more, but in that, in working with these people and getting them to connect with the emotional experience, it means letting go of some of that authoritarian structures. And I'm really interested in your experience of have people been able to do that? Have they been able to, through the training that you do, let go of some of that hierarchical power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got many, many, many stories of staff doing that. And what happens is it's an experiential training. So it's not something they're told. It's not a PowerPoint. It's very low tech. And what they experience is, number one, safety. They experience that we're all in this together, that there's, and they're connected to each other, and they experience trust, which does not exist much in paramilitary organizations. It's all the authority. And then they're given tools to basically live out this new self-identity. They see themselves differently, because what happens is they get in touch with themselves. They build up barriers. That's what trauma does. It builds up a barrier to your core so that you can protect yourself. So you build up all these barriers, and you, at the end, don't know who you are. You have disconnected so much. So if you're given the opportunity in safety, in a secure place, and in a group setting, it's really important that it be in a group setting, then you let those barriers down, and you connect with your own humanity. And I call it the innate health that we all have. We connect with that. And when that happens, I see things differently, because how we see ourselves is how we see the world. And one supervisor, his staff, a number of examples of supervisors, but his staff told me that this guy was by the book. It's my way or the highway. In staff meetings, never listened to his team. He always told them what they had to do and had absolutely no empathy for them at all. He went through the training and he came back, and this staff person said, he sat down and listened to us and said, how do we feel things need to move? How do we feel things need to change? He now felt secure enough in himself. As a supervisor, there are two roles, two ways I communicate. One, by rank, and two, by human to human. The more I depend on rank, the less effective I am and less secure I am in myself. The more I depend on people to people communication and not rank. You know, we've all who've worked in the system all seen when you say to the sergeant, but why do we have to do that? And he looks down at his arm at the three stripes and says, just points to it and said, that's why you've got to do it. That's the sign of an ineffective supervisor. So what happens in the training is they connect with themselves and feel more self-confident, so they no longer have to depend on the rank. It doesn't mean that they don't have final say, because you know that's always going to be the case in a paramilitary organization. But they use their rank less than they use their people-to-people communication and empathy. And once, what empathy is nothing more than my getting in touch with my own emotions as to how I would feel in the situation you are in. So if I'm disconnected from my emotions because of training, because of the work culture, then how can I have empathy? I can't have empathy. And if you don't have empathy, you're not a good supervisor, you're not a good parent, and you're not a good partner. And that's part of the reason why there are so many divorces, is because the staff disconnects from their empathy, from their own emotions, so they don't know how to relate to people on the outside, because you don't have that rank. When you're dealing with your wife or your husband, the rank doesn't matter. I don't care if you're a corporal, a sergeant, lieutenant, whatever. That does not matter in the home. So it's this connection with ourself that is so critical. And it's the base for emotional intelligence. The very first part of emotional intelligence is self-awareness. Once you can be more self-aware, then that literally changes everything for you. And you don't have to depend on, quote, the system to function.
Wow, John, you've raised a lot of issues in there that I can connect with. I often say to people, well, you know, and I hear about Bob the supervisor and all the things that you've mentioned, the lack of empathy, the reference to the rank, this isn't a discussion, this is really a telling you what to do. And I often think, well, Bob wasn't like that when he came in. You know, Bob's become like that over the years of the service. And I guess it's that core. What's your thoughts on the mixture of the trauma, the mixture of how you're treated, that starts this disconnecting from your own emotion or your own empathy or... what's your thoughts about the beginning of that process where you start to become disconnected? Because it certainly happens, and I see it all the time, where people are just disconnected from their humanness, you know.
Yeah. When you look at the statistics of PTSD, depression, anxiety, et cetera, suicide, et cetera, those start showing up within the first 3 to 5 years. And it's the culture that imposes that on you. How are folks trained? They're trained as warriors. But that's not their role. They picked it up from the military, where they train, they re-socialize you into an efficient killing machine. Is that what we want on our streets? Is that what we want in the prison system? So 90 to 95% of the training is that of a warrior. It's not they talk about being in service, but most of the training is that as a warrior. That's not what their jobs are really all about. You know, their jobs are, well, in the prison is rehabilitation, trying to create an environment where when the inmates leave, they are better than when they came. So that training, exactly what you were talking about, yes, sir, no, sir, out in the back alley where they line up and they do this very military thing, and they're trained in fear. They may not say so, but they're trained in fear. When you get in the pod and it is 60 inmates and you're trained to fear, so that you can respond quickly. When you're trained to fear, that puts the barrier between you and other people. And the thing is, it's not just between you and the inmates, it becomes you and the other staff. So that happens right in the very beginning. And I love the phrase that I learned a little while ago, that culture will eat policy for lunch. And that basically means that the culture changes everything. I did an assessment of a supervisor training and of what style they use for resolving conflicts. And they came all across the board. You know, there's competition, there's giving in, there's cooperation, there's compromise, collaboration, avoidance. There are basically five, I mentioned six, but there are basically five different ways that we can respond to conflict. So they were all over across the board. Was their natural tendency? I gave them a situation. How would you deal with this situation? 100% did it with competition. I'm going to get it over. I'm going to be the boss and I'm going to get my way. So that's the culture. So it's not only the training. And even if you try and provide some other kind of humanistic training, whatever you want to call it, you know, when they get out of the training academy and they get on the pod, they get on the job, frequently, the training academy taught you what they thought you needed to do, will teach you how you need to do your job. And that's what happens. They don't have a chance. They don't have a chance. And I think that's part of the reason. There are other reasons why there's such a high attrition rate. In Norway, they train their correctional officers totally differently. 2 years, first year psychology. The whole year is psychology. They have a waiting list for people wanting to become correctional officers. I don't know anywhere in the U.S., and I think you might agree with Australia, where there's a waiting list for folks to become correctional officers. So it starts from the very first day that they come to the training academy.
And in actual fact, here we can't find officers. You know, it's become less attractive to do this type of work. Yeah, there are again lots of ideas. The training. I'm fumbling around a bit, but often officers talk about, or one of the major fears for them, of course, is being injured, and then that training to, you know, you don't run from a conflict, you run to it, and the overriding of your natural instincts. And then, you know, and like obviously in the US and here, an officer can get significantly injured by some of the more violent prisoners. So there's an element of, what's the word? You're always at risk, and the hypervigilance and the, what's your thoughts on, you know, in a way I hear what you're saying, the training in a way kind of, well, this is what we've got to gear you up for in a way, but we don't actually give you the tools to deal with these scenarios. I'm really interested in your comments about that combination of the capacity to be seriously hurt and yet the trying to train officers in a different way.
You can never forget that there's risk. That's a given. As soon as you forget there's a risk, then you open yourself. If the only tool you have is a hammer, and you want to build a house, what's that house going to look like? It's not going to look very pretty. So what we need to do is to give better tools so that you prevent those situations from happening. You listen more carefully. You listen with your eyes as well as your ears. You know, this particular inmate is wearing socks and no shoes today. He never does that. So it's trying to be very perceptive, but having the tools to calm things before they get out of hand. If someone just came back from court and got a sentence of 5 more years, and you shouted him to get the hell into his cell and shut up, life is tough, you'll get a different response than if the person can really connect with them and make them feel like they're being heard and their pain is being acknowledged. you prevent a lot happening. But of course, you're going to get psychopaths. You're going to get folks that their intention is to do harm to you. So that's when those other tools come into play. So, yeah. And a lot has to do with staff trusting staff. If staff can trust staff that you've got my back, that we can work together to deal with this, where mental health and security work together. In one large county jail, whenever mental health would come on the unit, the COs would say, oh God, here they come. God, they don't understand count. They don't understand this. And man, they're just going to cause trouble. We had them all in a training together. After the training, the COs went to the mental health and said, how do we work together so maybe we can let you know before there's a crisis? Because what happens is they would wait until it was a crisis before they let mental health know. Now, because there was the trust, the connection, and the feeling that we're working together, now they let say to mental health, I'm some concerned about Charlie. He's not wearing shoes now. Can maybe you come and talk to him and maybe talk him down? So it's that cooperation. It's the tools they really need to effectively do their job. So, yes, that's...
Well, one of the things that, permeates certainly through all of the prisons I've been to is you can't get too, and I understand it, you can't get too close to the prisoner. You can't show over amounts of empathy or, you know, so often officers that do will be called soft cocks here or, you know, weak or, you know, get belittled, get ostracized, you know, as a part of those cultural tools. And I think it's still fair to say that's still a very dominant, don't get too close, can't trust them, understand where that comes from, but it's there. So that any officer that shows any of that capacity to kind of, let's try and understand the prisoner, will generally be not seen as, well, we don't do that, or that's not the way to go. So what you're talking about is an enormous flip, isn't it, to go, hang on a minute, we're all working together as a team here to try and understand the prisoner, but concurrently protect ourselves. what's your, you know, and clearly it's been very, very positive for you, you know, of actually starting to flip that. We're not at each other as staff, you know, because officers will say, if there's a code on and it's on, we'll be there to protect an officer whether we hate their guts. And it doesn't always work, but generally it does. But then when there's not the crisis, as you mentioned, well, then it's this malicious gossip and it's undoing each other and I'm going to put in a report about you for what you did, and it gets lost in this myriad of complaining and maliciousness and, you know, sometimes it's so destructive. That's what you're talking about, isn't it? You've actually got to start there of getting people to trust each other and to trust that as a team you'll actually work more effectively with the prisoner. Really interested in your comments.
Helping or trying to develop trust that in the inmate that you are not going to do them harm. You will do your job and you will not be manipulated. And if you ask for something that's inappropriate, the answer is no. Because then if I give you something inappropriate, then you're going to ask for something bigger and then something bigger. And this isn't just with the staff. If we can do the same thing with the inmates, give you a good example. We have a testimony about an inmate who went through AVP, the Alternative Violence Project. And he said that he's not a kind person. He spent the first half of his sentence in the hole and continuously beating up officers. He went through AVP and he was able to get in touch with his innate self, his innate health. And when he did that, that changed his whole perspective. So he had been in the hole for beating up an officer. And when he came out, his buddy said, okay, let's go after so-and-so. And this is after he had AVP. He said, I can't do that. I'm not there anymore. When I was into violence, I was going to be the best warrior I could be for violence. But now I'm into nonviolence, and I'm going to be the best nonviolent person I can. So I can't engage in that. So that's a matter of trust. And it's, you know, if you try and just simply implement something in a system that doesn't support it, it's not going to work. So it has to take time. And if you give the staff the skills, they will relate to the inmates. I had one CO say to me that before the training, when an inmate came up to him with an attitude, he gave it right back to him and he pushed him out of the office. He went through the training and he said, now I see things differently. And an inmate reported, I was fearful to go to him before he went to whatever this training was, which he didn't know. I was fearful to go to him even for a haircut because he chopped my head off. Now he listens to me. And now I will go and share information with him. This is called dynamic security. This is what they do in Norway, where now as a CO, I have a much clearer communication chain of what's going on in my unit, because now folks will tell me when something's gone awry. So many, many examples, and there will certainly be inmates that are mentally ill, and there's just, you got to deal with them, you know, with very strict guidelines, very strict parameters. But it's the idea that being nonviolent does not mean being soft. That's what folks will criticize it and saying, oh, you're goody-goody, you know, you're gonna get manipulated, etc. That's not what it's about. It's about setting boundaries, but also realizing that connecting with each other can be transformative.
Yes. And look, that picks up on the being able to individualize the prisoners, of the, mm-hmm. the one size doesn't mm-hmm. fit all, that mm-hmm. you, well, another point that crops up too is that, and you talk about it in the book, which I totally agree with, the lack of teams. So that if an officer has an issue, there's no team to go and talk to. You either go up the chain, and then, you know, who knows what response you're going to get, or you go sideways to colleagues. You know, it's not actually sitting down with the team and you go, I've actually got an issue, I've got something I'm not quite sure how to deal with, or I've got this prisoner, not quite sure how to approach them. And then you get that kind of, it's just totally lacking. And that's what you're really talking about, you know, that if you actually have developed teams that can individualize prisoners, can look at maybe this prisoner's got certain skills or is workable or is receptive to, and you treat them differently to how you might treat someone that's mentally ill, where you need more parameters. I'm not really aware of any of that here. Now, I might be wrong, and people please ring me or text me and let me know I'm wrong, but there's just nothing there at that level of skilling people up to you're quite right. You know, it is sort of, well, this is what we're trained to do, and we might spend half a day on case management or when you actually have to talk to the prisoners. Most officers hate that. Some really enjoy it. But yes, just some comments around, you know, that lack of team and what it does to people.
Mm-hmm. And the fear. If I'm in trouble, I can't go to my supervisor. I can't go to a psychologist because then I could, as a cop on the street, if I go to a psychologist because I have trouble, then I might lose my gun. And they may, you know, say, you've got a mental problem, you know, and I can't go to my family, you know, because often they're not supportive at that point. So they could be, but the end result is you're on your own. I heard an officer say, I felt like an orphan in my own department. So you don't have the resources that you need when you're in crisis. You know, and as we said earlier, if you experience a traumatic situation and you say, gee, I don't know if I can handle this. No, man up and or woman up, whatever, and get to the next task. And so there's no processing of that. And that builds. And that's the damage of chronic stress, is that it's all the time. When you look at the prison or you put on your uniform, you feel the adrenaline rush. You feel a difference. That's with you all the time. And that's where the harm comes, the physical and psychological harm comes. So that chronic stress has the same impact on the brain as does trauma. Because there's a lack of support and that lack of team. If you come back to your unit and talk with the guys and the other folks on the unit, the gals, and there would be some sort of support. So what's left? Often the bottle. And that's why there's such a high alcoholism, I know, in this country, and I assume it's probably true in Australia, but I don't know that. You would know that better than I would.
Look, I think officers often reference it in terms of when if you're having discussions around coping, well, I just drink. My sense is not quite as bad as maybe what it was 30 years ago, where the alcoholism was rampant in police and you know, correction officers. So it's clearly still an issue because the number of officers that reference that they do that because it's sort of quick. And look, it's that point that you make, John, that and it's I've been very aware of it, that it's not having the tools. It's not having the any form of, like, what's an example? I think I've given it before, where officers will say, you know, I sat in the car and I was fucking shaking like a leaf and couldn't get myself out of the car, eventually got myself out of the car, had a vomit in the toilet on the way in, and then got through the gate and got onto the post. What the fuck's happening? And to not even know that what anxiety is, going into a high risk, chronic stress, all these sorts of things, that the knowledge around what can happen from a body is not there. And just before I forget, I'm really interested in when you're running training with, say, the more experienced officers, you know, the 10, 15 plus years, where I always feel there's so much locked up trauma of stuff they've seen, stuff they've been involved in, and it's just when they start to connect with themselves at an emotional level, does that connect them with the trauma that they've experienced but never expressed?
Nope.
So tell me about that.
Okay. So what happens with trauma? I won't get too technical, but we have an amygdala, a hippocampus, and the neocortex. The amygdala is our fire alarm system. That's our fight flight. The hippocampus is memories where they're stored and integrated. And then the cortex is our thinking. So what happens with trauma and with chronic stress is those nerve endings in the brain that go from the amygdala to the hippocampus shut down. So those memories are no longer in the traumatic memory never gets to the hippocampus. That's why you'll get a flashback, and flashback will be as though you're there in the moment. It's because it hasn't been integrated in with other memories. So what the training does, we don't talk about the traumas that you have. That would be a lightning rod. I mean, that if people started, you know, talking all about their traumas, et cetera, that's not what the training is about. But what happens is you create that sense of safety, which does not exist on their job, that sense of safety. And you can do that through play, through fun. And there are specific exercises that I do in a certain sequence that within the space, even if they come to the training very angry that they were mandated to come, and what is this BS all about? Within 2 hours, they are acting like kids. They are having fun. And this is warden down the CO, medical, maintenance, what have you, psychology. They're all together connected. So what happens is the amygdala quiets down because it's no longer needed, because it's not a fearful situation. There's not a stressful situation, you know. And when that happens, then things get integrated into the hippocampus and the memory. And it's a natural way. It can be a partial healing. I'm not saying that therapy is not necessary or not important, but it can be, at least on the surface, a partial healing so that they no longer are so reactive and controlled by that unresolved trauma.
Now, that is highly skilled work. And when I read your book, I realized just how highly skilled this work is. I can remember it wasn't in Victoria or somewhere else, but a GM just wandered by, you know, and dropped in and, oh, yeah, thanks for coming. And then just sort of in the next 10 minutes told me, sort of in a way, in an emotionless way, every trauma he'd been through. Oh, I've been through this, and, you know, cutting prisoners down, and, you know, bodies all falling apart, but with a persona, but I'm okay, you know. And I've had it happen a lot with police officers, with, you know, I've seen this, seen that, and they'll tell me every trauma that they've been through, and it does give you this sense of, my God, all this stuff is locked up. You know, it's never processed at the time. It's get back on the horse. And you hear some horrendous things of what people have seen, but no emotional, you just deal with it, you know, you just fucking deal with it, you know, that's what you do. And that's why it's really interesting to me that if you take away the danger or the fear and you create safety, there's a different pathway to getting some relief.
You can't heal the trauma.
You can't heal it.
But you can heal the effects of the trauma.
Yes.
And that's what's messing up your life.
Yes. Well, and you're providing an experience that they don't get.
They've never had.
And look, it made me think of in 2016.
Let me interrupt and just say one thing.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm highly skilled. I've been doing this for 30 years. I needed that experience in the mental health background to be able to create the training. The training can be easily taught to anybody who has basic communication skills. And so I've trained training academy staff. I've trained line staff. I've trained COs, sergeants, lieutenants to provide the training. Because as long as you understand that you're not the boss, you're not telling them what they should do, you are basically helping them experience these specific exercises, which are very simple. I'll give you one of the most powerful exercises for creating safety. It's called concentric circles. You get two circles and people pair up, and they speak to each other for 2 minutes. One person speaks for 2 minutes, then the other person speaks for 2 minutes. On these six topics, a positive childhood memory of mine is someone I really respect and why, how I handle conflict, how my family handled conflict was growing up, something I've done that I'm proud of, how I deal with my anger and conflict now, and something I've learned from my life experience that's important to me. So that starts off fairly easily. And when was the last time they thought of a positive childhood experience? Then that puts your mind back to that place. And yet there's still some challenging ones, like how do you deal with conflict and anger now? Self-awareness. And it's unbelievable. I've had, I can think of maybe of the thousands of correction staff I've worked with, maybe 5 or 10 who couldn't get into that, but all the others do. And one of the important things, even if they don't answer the topics, if they're talking, that's really important. So that's how simple it can be. You know, if you just have the steps, and because this is an innate process, it's an, it's a natural process that we're talking about. It's not just some highfalutin academic thing. This is people basically getting in touch with themselves. And it's true across the road, across, you know, literally across the world. The same model is used in Africa to heal from trauma. It's used in Colombia to heal from trauma. And it, because we're all the same, we're all the same. And it simply works, and it's not that complicated. And my goal is to train staff to be able to provide the training. So it's ongoing.
And, you know, it made me think when I read the book and talking to you, you know, back in 2016 when I did some training in four of our maximum security prisons, and it was a very new experience for me. I'd seen counsellors and seen correction officers individually. And I remember one of the senior ops managers at the prison that activated it and it got funded. You know, he said to me, he said, look, don't come out and show the officers the fucking overheads. You know, that just bores them. They clock out. I just want you to come and sit with them and talk to them about their mental health. And it suited me fine, you know, my narrative background, it's the way I wanted to do it. And so I sat with these officers over the course of 2016, just me and my little handout that I did on, you know, managing stress. And every session I did, the officers say, we never do this. We never sit together and talk about each other. Now, I was very focused on, which is me, the content of what people were saying, how they were expressing their experience. And Code mm-hmm. Blue is very much about capturing that. This is what the officers said.
Excellent book, by the way. Very
thank
excellent
you.
Book.
I didn't really take that to the next level of, well, what did I actually provide for them? Yeah, I kind of knew I'm providing an opportunity to share with each other, and which they did. They shared all sorts of things with each other. But I did it in a very, you know, I didn't set out to create trust or, you know, I didn't really think through the process or do any further analysis of, I knew that it was a positive experience. I mean, the evaluations, you know, showed me that. But then it was never picked up. That training was never picked up. And I assumed naively that it would be, and it wasn't. It just wasn't picked up. And then with doing the training with Katerina, you know, the from correction fatigue to fulfillment, that hasn't been picked up. No one's interested in doing that. And when I did actually get a prison that was interested in doing it, it was really quite like what you're talking about. It was quite an amazing experience. You know, all of those, I did four sessions at a rural prison, and all of those senior prison officers said they were going to spend more time going back to their unit staff and communicating with them. So I got a little touch of that, of what that training could do. But sadly, never really ever had the opportunity to deliver it, because no one was interested in it. No one, you know, it's all, I don't know. You know, I have absolutely had no positive response to the thought of that training from anywhere, really. But when I, you know, we've talked and in reading the book, it sort of hit me about what Katerina's training does, is it provides a similar to talk about yourselves in a safe environment. What are the things you prioritise? All those people sort of questions that I don't think any correction officer or senior or governor could tell me that that's ever done. You know, self-awareness, it's never talked about. It's never...
It's threatening to the system.
It's threatening to the system. And now tell me about the emotional intelligence. I loved it. I've heard of emotional intelligence a lot. Never really have gone in and read anything about it. So loved it. Just tell me a bit about that, the self-awareness, all those sort of human things that I think even I've lost connection with. So tell me about emotional intelligence. I want the listeners to hear it.
Well, it starts off with self-awareness, because if you can, well, I've already talked about self-awareness. So it starts off with self-awareness, which then goes to empathy. And then let me hang on just a second. You get self-awareness, empathy, and then you get personal responsibility. And the personal responsibility is that what I do matters. That's initiative. It's also integrity, that I am good to my word, and that I understand the interconnectedness of people. And when that happens, then I have emotional management. And that allows me to manage relationships and situations because now I'm aware of where I'm coming from. I'm also aware of where the other person's coming from. I developed kind of an acronym, not quite an acronym, called STORE. And what that is if you're in a situation where you feel provoked, you stop. You take a moment to take a deep breath. Then you think about what is happening and then you respond. But the key here is you don't, when your amygdala, your anger is hijacked, if you can stop and then take a deep breath, what you have done is you've gotten out of your emotional mind into your observing mind. Now I can step back. And now I can think about what kind of response is best in this situation. And I was watching a video, and it was a video on racism. And it was this woman coming in, saying some very, white woman, saying some very racist things to this black woman. And just watching the video, I could just feel my anger coming up. And I'm going to say, who the hell do you think you are? My God, that is the most despicable thing. But I stopped. I took a deep breath. I thought, and then my response was saying to her, I'm sorry you have so much anger. I'm sorry that you see so much threat from this woman who's done absolutely nothing to you. You see the difference? That's what emotional intelligence is, being aware of what's happening, of yourself and of others, and trying to apply a more effective response. Rather than reacting, you respond to get you where you want to go. I wanted that woman to change her behavior. I may not have been able to, but it certainly was more likely than if I'd gone after her and say, you racist, blah, blah, blah. So that's, to me, is what emotional intelligence is.
And so, yeah, so it's sort of in a way, it's teaching officers to, you just don't standard think of things, right? This is a control issue. Do this. Take the deep breath, pause, have a look at what's happening, and then process it.
Yep. Respond, don't react.
Yes.
Because an inmate comes up to my face and says something, and that CO I talked about before, his reaction was bam, get right into his face, push him back. What he did now was he said, George, I didn't make you angry. Did I? Well, no, you didn't. It was the system and da, da, da. He says, well, why don't you go out of my office and come back in and we can start this conversation again. Now he's shown respect for him and acknowledged him. And that is what we all want. We all want to be respected and acknowledged. Like what you were doing with that stress, that your trainings or your workshops, showing respect for them, acknowledging so that they felt heard and they felt seen. If I don't feel heard or seen, we all know this with kids, if they don't feel heard or seen, they will be heard and they will be seen, but just not the way you would like them to be. Adults are the same way. If we can show them that respect, and it doesn't take more energy, you know, and the end result is I am more calm. I am in more control. And because once it goes ballistic, I'm no longer in control. And that's where you end up with violence. And most situations, I'm not going to say all, but most situations are preventable. Most situations are preventable if we approach it in the right way. And that means we've been trained with the tools to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's, I was just thinking as you're talking, you know, that the skills that we all have and that you become disconnected from, and what the trainee does, which is really, what's the word, positive, it's really to think that, well, okay, you haven't lost those skills. You might look like you have, but they're there to be reconnected with. And because sometimes I'll have more insightful officers will say to me, I don't like what I've become, you know, or family members have commented, or you're just not who you used to be. And they can pick up on that, and it can worry them in terms of I've become something that I don't like. And then so that process of reconnecting back to who you want to be, who the values that you do still have, you do have, I can really get you need the context to do that.
Let me go back to what you had asked a little bit earlier. And I think what you were asking is, what do you do with the hardheads? What do you do with someone who's been in the system for 20 years? Okay. So the trainings that I have done mostly have not been at the academy. They've mostly been with veteran staff who've been there for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, and who you would consider to be hardheads. Their evaluations would blow your socks off. 100% positive. When was the last training methodology that you knew that was 100% positive evaluations? That is, 77% said the training was excellent, 20% said it was very good, and 3% said it was good. 0% said it was fair, 0% said it was poor. And this is over hundreds of workshops. So people want this. You know, the testimonial, you know, the evaluations at the end of the training, you know, I learned to trust when I didn't think I could. My wife has seen a change in me at home. You know, I now see how I can do my job more effectively and how I think I can retire in this profession. It's amazing the impact. These people want it, but they don't know they want it. They need it. They don't know they need it. Now, you don't come in and say, I'm going to train you in emotional intelligence, because then the door closes right there. You know, they're closed off. They're not going to do that. But you come in and you call it team building or attitude, basically team building, and they're much more open to that. But once they've experienced the first hour or two, they're hooked. They're having fun. One of the very first, what we call light and livelies, is called big wind blows, where there's one fewer chair and people are sitting in a circle. So the person in the middle calls out a characteristic. And it's amazing. When was the last time as an adult we played? If we didn't play with kids, when was the last time we played for pure joy? Not to win. I mean, years ago when I played tennis, when I played, I enjoyed it, but I was out there to win. But played a game that was purely for the joy of it. They get up, they physically move, they're bouncing off each other. And these are wardens and COs and sergeants, etc. And we also pick something called adjective names. We only use first names. Titles, last names are never used. And by doing just first names, now we're on an equal basis. And the transformation with the different levels is amazing. Absolutely amazing. Because it's a human, you know. We're letting our barriers down and we're left with our humanity. So long time, I don't care how hard-headed you are. I've had one person in the thousands I've worked with who after 3 hours sat there, refused to participate. And I asked him, do you really want to be here? And he said, hell no, I don't want to be here. And I said, fine, go talk to your supervisor. It's not my issue. I didn't mandate you coming. But nobody else. It's pretty phenomenal. And it's easy. It's not complicated. You don't need a PhD to be able to provide this. And as you said, you don't have PowerPoint. So you can do it anywhere without a computer. You know, and it's...
Mm. So John, just some thoughts on... now, obviously, in the States, you've had prison organizations open up to the idea of the training, mm-hmm. and that obviously means accepting, well, maybe my staff do need this experience, mm-hmm. and maybe it might be beneficial in tackling the work culture issues. Is that a growing awareness? Has it been a battle to get the systems to recognize, let's just start with your people. Let's just provide an experience for them where they can connect with each other.
It's always a battle. It's always a battle. If you can get the commissioner, the secretary, the top person, if you can get them convinced, or somebody at the decision-making level, then they can say to the warden, you've got to have this in your training. We had a prison here, Pasquotank, where four staff were brutally murdered by inmates. And this was a year later. I came in and did the training, and they wanted me to come and do the training because they had to heal. And the warden said it was just amazing, the healing that took place, with this training from that trauma. So it's decision makers, leadership in corrections and police, listen to leadership in corrections and police. They don't basically listen to academia. Now, there's some that do. We had a director of our community corrections here who was very innovative. There have been other wardens who are very innovative and open to new ideas and doing things, but so often that's not the case. Out of fear, they don't want to take the risk. You're going to come in and work with the staff, you could really mess things up. You could almost cause a riot within the staff if you don't know what you're doing. So there's fear of not wanting to do that. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. Because if someone reads it, they will understand why it's important to look at the psychological needs of staff. They're not there just as a robot, just to fill a seat, as you said, bum in the seat. That if we can meet their psychological needs, then what we have done is created a workforce that's going to stay. If we don't create their psychological needs, they're gone. They're gone. And that's what Norway has done. These officers feel they have meaningful jobs. They enjoy their jobs. And they feel well-equipped to do their jobs. So they don't go. And therefore, they have a waiting list for folks to want to get in.
Yeah, I love the way you put it, because it's just to the core, and it's, you don't need a PhD to understand it. It really is, and I guess that's the battle for me here, is to persist that we have to go back to the experience that people are having and connect with it and give them an opportunity to connect with their own. And that's why I love that idea of that connecting with where you are, who you are, what you feel, and you've got the freedom to feel. And we've just got a long way to go here. Some final comments for the listeners around that opening yourself up to the emotional experience. It's not the enemy. It's not going to undo you. And that's why I love that kind of providing an experience that doesn't need you to disclose trauma, but it provides a healing alternative. Just some final comments, John, about all of that.
I think the training is incredibly valuable as part of a program. I think they need to take a look at their policies and how their policies promote people having their sense of belonging, their sense of meaning, their sense of control, and the sense of fun. Those are the basic psychological needs. And if you can look at your policies and see how, and understand what motivates staff. Staff want to feel like administration supports them. Staff want to feel like they have some control over their jobs, that they're respected, that they're valued. And that will happen if, as part of an overall program, you implement this training at all levels. But you need those things. And the book very clearly shows what things can happen in the organization. It doesn't say what specific policy, but it says what policies need to promote. And then it also talks about individual resilience, and that we need, because the job is so stressful, we really need to give the staff the tools to be personally resilient. And that means how to have healthy relationships with your partner, volunteering in the community, exercise. You know, obesity is a huge issue. Exercise is one of the best things you can do for your brain. It literally is one of the best things. And to teach them, one of your speakers before, I can't remember his name, you probably can, came up with a plan where when you start in the system, you develop a plan on what your resources are when you get stressed. And then you, how you can be aware of when you are really stressed, and then how you can implement that plan. But you do that the first day that you come in or when you start training at the training academy. And the training academy needs to teach staff how they can be resilient. Because then they will feel like they have a meaningful job, you know, and stay.
And that your emotional reactions are valid and important.
Absolutely.
And don't get disconnected from them. Mm-hmm. Well, look, John, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I'll go back over it. And there's a lot of points that come out of it that are so important. And as I said, I love your book, and thank you so much for doing it.
Appreciate it. And share the book, because I'd love to come to Australia. And do some trainings.
I would love to come get you to come to Australia. John, thank you so much, and I've loved it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. If you would like to get in touch with me, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636. Today, my guest is Greg Moore.